This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. You're listening to The Cable this Monday evening. I think it's the 5th. I put my Christmas tree up this weekend. I hope you did too. I'm Guy Johnson in London. Alex Steele is over in New York. She hasn't. I'm just going to point that one out. The big debate today is whether or not we're going to see a Santa Claus rally or whether or not we're going to see the Grinch. I think we all know who the Grinch is this evening. Let's talk about where equity markets is. She's going to come back in a minute. Let's see where equity markets are. Down. And I think we can blame the Americans for this. We saw some very strong ISM services data out a little bit earlier on. The theory here is that good news for the economy is bad news because the Fed is going to tighten more, and that's bad news for risk assets like equities. The dollar, though, is back on the front foot. Certainly the pound, which was positive a little earlier on, now trading at 121.66.
I should point out, though, that we did break below the 200-day moving average on the S&P, and we did that Friday. So, yes, I appreciate that the services data was hot, so you're going to have some selling, but you're going to have some follow-through selling also from the technical level there on Friday. Also, the reason why the Grinch thing is funny is because we all know that Guy is the Grinch.
Well, apparently not.
There's a British form. Here's my thing. Why are you going to put the tree up? Like 4 weeks before Christmas. I mean, by Christmas, it's going
to
be grounding on the edges.
To enjoy the festive season. It will not. I will water it. It will be fine.
But we water it too, but it only lasts for a bit.
Yeah.
I wonder if actually the deeper conversation here is how we heat our homes. Because the heat in New York apartments can be just so debilitating that, like, no matter how much you water the thing, it just dies on you. And I wonder if this is the distinction.
Is that because you've got... like, you can't control your central heating?
Not really. Like, you can. Like, you can turn off the heat, but sometimes the pipes just get so overdone and, like, the heat just comes out and, like, nothing you can do except for turning it off altogether, but then it gets really cold, is enough. In our old apartment, the heat used to be so intense you'd have to wear, like, tank tops around the apartment, and even if you turned it off, it was still hot.
I do remember. I remember visiting a friend of mine, and he had, like, this huge pipe that went through his apartment in New York. And I think it was steam or whatever was in there. But winter or summer, this thing was red hot.
Yeah. And that's the apartment building thing versus like a home where you have a little bit more control over it. I wonder if this is actually the deeper conversation we need to be having about Christmas trees.
Maybe. Anyway, mine's up. Very happy with it. Looks good. My son and I chose it the weekend. Looks very nice. I'm just going to point it out. Maybe
I'm
not the Grinch.
Very
Maybe
happy for
I
you.
Am not the Grinch. I've gone early on Christmas. Anyway, Charlie Pellett is here to bring us back to what we really need to be talking about. Those are the headlines. Charlie, over to you.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Thank you very much indeed. And here's what's going on. Britain's National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers has rejected an offer from the rail delivery group aimed at ending a strike action plan before Christmas. The offer proposed a pay rise of 4% in 2022 and 2023, but the union claims it is conditional on many changes to working conditions, including job losses, reducing train staff on board, and the closure of all ticket offices. The offer is the first in months, according to the RMT, and comes after the Department for Transport gave the Rail Delivery Group, which negotiates on behalf of rail operating companies, a mandate to make a proposal. Sources tell Bloomberg the UK government is set to announce a package aimed at boosting growth in financial services and the City of London on Friday. One of the sources says the Treasury is in the process of finalizing the package and has penciled in the end of the week for the announcement. The cost of a two-year fixed-rate mortgage has fallen below 6% for the first time in almost 9 weeks as the UK's home loans crunch eases off. The average two-year fixed-rate mortgage fell to 5.99% today, this according to Money Facts Group. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, Thank you very much indeed. I'm sure Charlie's got his tree up already. I'm sure he's good to go on that front. Anyway.
Do you? Wait, hold on. Do you have your tree up?
We do not. Not in the Pellet household.
Oh, Charlie.
See, so, I think it's a coastal situation.
Well, that's part of it. But also, too, in fairness to us, we haven't yet decided because we are going away for a couple of weeks in December. Mm-hmm. So we've got to make a decision there. My bigger concern right now is a possible baggage handler strike at Heathrow, because wouldn't you know it, my connecting flight is on British Airways, heading over to Belgium, heading up to the Swiss Alps to ride a train through the Alps, surprise, surprise, and then down to Italy. So
I would double check. Nice. I'm not entirely sure it's going to affect Terminal 5.
And I'm not sure either, Guy. I saw the story last Friday about Menzies affecting some carriers, not all carriers, but yes, and there's still a couple of weeks to go.
I think it might be pronounced Mingus, but I'm...
Well, I think you're 100% right. Spelt
Menzies. That's what I just usually say. Yeah. Guy's right. Whatever Guy said.
Yeah. I wish you would do that, but you don't.
A good point. It's kind of my motto.
Because it is usually true.
It's a bumper sticker.
Cheers, mate.
Anyway, Charlie, thank you very much indeed. Guy is always right. Never hear those words. Okay, let's talk about what we got in terms of the day's fronts out of Europe today. Compare and contrast. So US ISM services data comes through 50 strong. What was the number, Alex? 56 or something like that? It was a real blowout number, and it's really surprised everybody. 56.5. So a much higher than expected number. Here in Europe, we've seen services PMI data today. Now, services are holding up relative to manufacturing, but are still firmly below 50. The other takeaway from the PMI data today was I thought we saw some signs of stabilization, which I think is interesting as well. So let's get a read on what is happening here. We're joined now by Bloomberg's chief European economist, Jamie Rush. Jamie, talk me through how you've read the data today. This is data. I'm looking at the PMI data. Yes, it's stabilizing, but still, it looks recessionary.
Doesn't it? And I think it's the most of the survey indicators across Europe are pointing towards a downturn. The PMIs are basically consistent with like something relatively shallow. When you look at other indicators such as consumer confidence or more household-based surveys, it would lead you to believe that we're in for the biggest recession in history. I think the PMIs, though, are probably the better gauge, and we're on track for...
Did we lose you?
I think we might have done.
I think we did. We'll try and get him back. I think the connection there was not so great. But so I guess my other takeaway for that was that the strong jobs within the PMI. I mean, what did you make of that? That was so a little perplexing.
So the labor market is holding up, and I think you're seeing this on both sides of the Atlantic. Particularly in Europe, though, I think you're seeing companies hoard labor. I think you're seeing it on both sides of the Atlantic, actually. I think there is an awareness of how tricky it can be to hire people, and as a result of which they are hanging on to people. Which is interesting because the big fear here in Europe is that we are going to see second round effects. And we're starting to see some evidence of that coming through. Because maybe labor does have a little bit more power in this downturn because of the tightness of the labor market, you could see quite decent pay settlements coming through. And this is what the big fear is. And this is kind of the second round effects, the embedding of inflation, which central banks are really worried about. We saw, which airline was it earlier that got a massive pay rise?
Delta. United or Delta? One of those two.
One of those two. I think it's like a sort of 34% pay rise over
four years.
Mm-hmm. Which is, those are decent pay rises. And if you start to see some of that being reflected elsewhere, then I think this is what central banks are really going to fit. Jamie, I understand, is back. We have resolved the technical issue. Jamie, Alex was bringing up the issue of what we saw in the employment component of the PMI data, pointing to a fairly solid labour market. How sustainable is this if we are going to see a recession?
Well, I think the labour market is probably going to loosen up a little bit, but we're talking about a modest, relatively short-lived recession. And given how difficult it has been for companies to find staff in the last 6 months to a year, it's unlikely that they're going to let people go. So I think the labour market is probably going to hold up. So what's going to happen with pay? Well, hopefully, as headline inflation starts to fall back, that kind of pressure, that kind of motive to push for higher wage gains will start to disappear. But it's going to take quite a long time. You can't rely only on labour market slack, I think, in the Eurozone for inflation pressure to disappear.
But, What does that do for productivity and the long-term landscape of the job market then, if you have labor hoarding?
Well, I think in the short term, you will see labor productivity falling off just because you will have this weakness in demand. They're not willing to let people go. And therefore, you're going to see productivity falling, which, of course, is a problem for companies because it squeezes their margins and makes it harder for inflation to come down. If they've got people on the payroll but they're not making anything, it's pushing costs up. So, I mean, everything is pointing really to a fairly prolonged, sticky period of high-ish inflation in the Eurozone and the UK and elsewhere.
So where does that leave the ECB? The consensus now seems to be that 50 basis points is probably what we're going to get from the next meeting in a few days' time. But I talked to economists, and Alex and I talked to another one today, who's still not prepared to rule out 75, that the ECB decides that, exactly as the backdrop you just laid out, that actually it continues to need to be hawkish. The only reason they might not do that is that it would signal a much more sort of hawkish path. People would extrapolate from that decision.
Yeah, I think that's right, Guy. Why did we do 75 basis point hikes? It was done because they were catching up and it was panic stations. Headline inflation was rocketing and it was just felt there was a need to do something and be seen to be doing something. I think now that headline inflation is starting to fall back a little bit, and it will do over the beginning of next year, I think the pressure is off to do outside moves. So I think we step down to 50, we probably have another 50 after that, and then maybe step down to 25 thereafter.
Well, but if we go back to the labor hoarding thing for a second, doesn't that imply that the ECB is going to have to crush demand that much more to sort of shake up the labor hoarding, like crush demand till it's like a tiny ant on the ground?
Well,
go ahead.
I think reasonable people can disagree about how much pressure there is, underlying pressure there is in the Eurozone. And, actually, when you look at Isabel Schnabel, who's one of the executive committee members of the Governing Council Executive Board, Philip Lane, chief economist, they don't agree on how much slack there is. If you listen to Philip Lane, he says if you just get through this period, then it's all going to fall back away anyway. Isabel Schnabel much more worried about expectations feeding inflation. But my view is that you'll probably be able to do what has been done on interest rates now is actually already a lot. It's going to take at least a percentage point off the level of GDP next year, maybe even more than that. Labor market's going to be relatively solid, but people are going to feel this pinch, and it's going to affect wage negotiations a touch. So I think the ECB can probably begin to think about pausing in the first half of next year, maybe even at the end of the first quarter.
Is 50 basis points plus a solid date for QT the same as 75 basis points in monetary policy terms?
I think it depends on how fast they do QT. So they've got a couple of options there, haven't they? They can just let it run off naturally, or they could try and speed it up or slow it down, of course. I mean, they can choose to calibrate how fast they run off that bond portfolio. So it will come down to, and this is probably the big debate that's happening at the Governing Council now, is it will be more about the modalities around the QT program than it will be around the 50 basis points, which I think is probably a done deal. So I think it will, the hawkishness, if it comes through, will be expressed as a faster pace of QT.
When you look at your forecast for next year, literally what kind of weather do you factor into it?
We've factored in slightly warmer weather.
But isn't that kind of crazy that you have to factor that into your inflation and growth forecast?
Yeah. When you're multiplying an economic forecast by a weather forecast, I think you can probably guess how accurate it's likely to be over the next 6 months. But it is, it's the biggest thing. Like, it's suddenly turned cold. It's already focused minds on what's happening this winter, and gas prices have shot up again. Not to where they were in the summer, but it's still the big flux variable that's happening over the winter.
That's amazing. That's one of the best descriptions. We were joking with HSBC's chief European economist a little bit earlier on about kind of whether or not anybody knows anything going forward from here, and whether or not economists know even less. And I think you've just nailed it on the head. An economic forecast multiplied by a weather forecast equals
who knows? Equals big question mark.
Yeah, it's I don't envy you your job at the moment, Jamie. Thank you very much indeed. I always appreciate talking to you, though. Love talking to you. Thank you very much. Bloomberg's Jamie Rush, Chief European Economist at Bloomberg Economics. Alex, it is a genuine question. The weather is about to get really cold here. And critically, what's going to happen is that we're not going to have any wind either. So it's not even that it's going to get cold. You've also got to look at kind of what happens with the wind speed as well. Because it can be cold, but if it's cold and windy, that's okay because the turbines are being driven. If it's cold and no wind, that's a disaster.
Or it's like cold, not windy, and dark. Like that. Then you don't get solar either. And that's like the triptych there. But but that's going to be an absolute inflation and growth input. I don't know how you start modeling something like that because no one likes to be weather forecasters. It's an unloved job. Anyway, talk about an unloved job. We'll talk more about Credit Suisse and a possible investment into its investment bank spinoff. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London alongside Alex Steele over in New York. Let's talk about what's happening with Credit Suisse. Wow, what a roller coaster this bank, this stock has been on. So over the last 2 days, the stock is up by 12%. Prior to that, it had been falling and falling hard. Year to date, it is still a stock that is down by 63.6%. We're about to have a capital raise, but today there was more good news. Friday there was good news, today there was more good news. Today's good news came in the form of a story on the Bloomberg talking about the idea that that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince might be looking to invest in the investment banking spin-off that Credit Suisse's management is now proposing. That was certainly a source of significant stability. We don't know some of the details around exactly how that deal could be put together, how the Crown Prince would be acting. There's various kind of things that we still need to find out. So let's talk about it a little bit more and go to the kind of the source of all of these stories. And that is Bloomberg's Marion Halftermeyer, who joins us now from Zurich. Marion, how much do we actually know about the Crown Prince's potential interest in this division of Credit Suisse?
We know that there is some interest, and it looks like there might be an interest of putting at least $500 million into the vehicle. The bank has guided to us, you know, about a month ago that they were talking with third parties for investments in this vehicle, and that they had lined up some financing with some parties, and that they're continuing to talk to a number of other ones as well. So, but this is certainly interesting and does show that there is a lot of interest in investing in Credit Suisse despite all the turmoil that's happening there right now.
Do we know if it's a Saudi investment vehicle or MBS personally?
We're not 100% sure on that, and I don't think the distinction is necessarily that critical, necessarily. There's another part of the Saudi sort of empire. The Saudi National Bank is investing in Credit Suisse from the point of the capital raise. They are becoming an anchor investor, and they'll end up with 9.9%. So it certainly shows a sort of conglomerate interest from the Saudi is the Crown Prince and the various vehicles that they have to invest in companies.
Why would the Saudis want to do this?
It's a good question. Credit Suisse has had a long history of Middle Eastern backers. They have the Qataris who've been in there since the financial crisis. The Saudis have a lot of money to put to work right now, and they have a program where they want to be investing outside of the kingdom and into, you know, the diverse set of industries. So Credit Suisse and the financial services industry is one part of that. And certainly there's another side to this, which is Michael Klein, who happened to be on the Credit Suisse board. He's a veteran deal maker, has made his name in investment banking, and is going to be running this Credit Suisse First Boston. So that's under a very strong leadership. And he has very strong ties to the Middle East from his past deal-making days.
How much money does this investment spinoff going to need, and who else might be interested?
That is a million-dollar question. It's not quite clear yet just how much the bank is going to need and how much it's willing to give away, right? So right now it's still wholly owned by the bank, and they've expressed that they want to keep some kind of shareholding stake in that. Then you have to think about, okay, how much money does this entity need to fund the employees, the star bankers, and then also from a leverage finance perspective, who's going to bring in the capital to really support any deal-making activity? So there's a lot of questions that still need to be answered, and they'll be figuring that out. They've said they will be figuring that out over the course of the next year.
In terms of, you talked to a lot of people in Zurich, is everybody confident that Credit Suisse will weather this?
That's a really difficult question to answer. I think everyone's taking it day by day. The bank is solid. They have liquidity. They have capital. There's no question about its foundations. But I think the reputational hit has been really hard to digest, and they've been grappling with it for the last 2 to 3 years with the thing after thing after thing, right? And so it's sort of, you know, you don't want to say, okay, we're done. We're going to, you know, recover now, because you never know if there might be just another thing that comes out that might, you know, put another wrench in the plan. So I think there's a lot of hesitancy to say, okay, the path is clear now.
Can I ask a really dumb question? If Credit Suisse can't really be rescued, or it doesn't work, like, what happens to the Swiss government? Like, can they take it over? Can they buy a stake? Like, what's the relationship there?
I think you have to maybe take from, like, lessons learned from the UBS crisis, post-financial crisis, where the government had to step in and sort of do a sort of bailout. It, obviously, this wouldn't be the same situation because it wouldn't be a bailout scenario, but I think the government would have a hard time letting it fail, given that it is important for the Swiss economy, and particularly on the retail side as well. It is a big bank here. So you probably, you know, the stock is cheap. You're probably going to end up with some offers on the table. Whether or not they want to actually exercise those offers is a different story. Mm-hmm. But eventually, if the turnaround plan doesn't work, the next solution is being bought, right? The next solution is being broken up. And whether that's forced by the Swiss government asking the main competitor here, UBS, to merge with them, or some other entity buying them up, that remains to be seen.
All right. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate Maren Heftmeyer joining us there on Credit Suisse. And, you know, Guy, if you take a look at Euro Stoxx 50 Bank Index, you know, we've talked about it. It's in a bull market since the low that it hit in October. And Credit Suisse is, like, not participating in that. So, you know, any kind of juice that you're going to get from, say, higher rates, or buying any sort of value stocks, it ain't going to be Credit Suisse.
It's amazing, isn't it? European banks have been massive outperformers. European banks.
Yeah.
Kind of confounding expectations in an economy that looks like it's kind of rolling over, doing really, really well. And a lot of people are now questioning how much further that could go. I have to say, I'm looking at the screen now. US equities are really getting dinged.
Yeah.
They got dinged by that ISM number a little earlier, and it's continued.
It's, again, to keep perspective of the fact that last week on Friday, we broke below that 200-day moving average. So that's a key. So you're going to have some follow-through selling. We also had a really big run-up on, like, no news. So you can make an argument that you want to sell the rip when you're going into the end of the year.
Okay. Up next, we're going to talk about commodities.
Ah, so boring. Commodities are the worst.
Alex Steele. anyway, Alex's favorite subject coming up next. She's very excited. We're going to be joined by Emma Ross Thomas. There's plenty to talk about. We've got these Russian oil sanctions taking effect. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the impact that the cap is going to be having on Russian oil. There's a lot of nuance surrounding this whole story, and whether or not it will work remains an open question. Anyway, that's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. As Guy was pointing out before the break, we're definitely seeing the downside here to U.S. equities. S&P rolling over even more, down 1.4%. Volumes also picking up. Bond yields are climbing. You had the ISM services number coming in higher than expected. The employment part of that picture also quite strong, and that, of course, makes everyone worried about a wage price spiral and that the Fed will have to act even more. It's like a redux on Friday, like good news for the economy, bad news for the equity market. The Russell 2000, those small cap stocks really sensitive to rising rates, were down by about a 2%, more like 77 basis points for that 2 and the 10-year as it continues to invert. That's a quick snapshot here of U.S. markets. Now let's get more from Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much. And here's what's going on, Alex. Temperatures are expected to plummet below freezing from Britain to the Nordics this week, boosting energy demand and testing the region's ability to withstand a cold winter. The Met Office says a chilly Arctic maritime air mass is likely to drive temperatures to as low as minus 10 Celsius by the end of the week in the UK, potentially with snow and wintry showers in the south. Meanwhile, Britain's natural gas is still flowing to mainland Europe at a time when the fuel would typically be kept at home, underlining the country's key role in keeping the continent warm this winter. UK flows through the interconnector pipeline to Belgium, the biggest of the two links between the regions, are the highest for the time of year since at least 2016. That's unusual for December, when exports normally stop or even reverse as it gets colder and UK heating demand jumps. A wave of strikes heading for Britain's train network has been extended to an extra day after a union said engineers would walk out on Great Western Railway next week. The Unite Labour Group says the workers will take further action on the line, which connects London to the west of England and parts of Wales, on December 15th. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
Is it negative 10 Celsius?
Yeah, it's chilly.
That's cold.
That's cold,
exactly.
That's
14 degrees
for us. Exactly.
That's like not okay.
Yeah, not. It reminds me of the so-called Beast from the East a couple of years ago, and I was over in Europe when that hit, and yes, that
this
was cold.
This reminds me of college.
What temperatures of water freeze?
32.
That seems logical.
Yes.
Where are you going with this guy?
Yeah, I don't know.
We're waiting for the punchline.
No, I'm just saying that seems logical. Yeah.
We're cold.
Water freezes at zero would seem a more logical place to start. I bring it up for.
He's so smart.
Yep,
whatever guy just said. Let's just go with that.
Yep, exactly. Bottom line, it's going to be chilly. It's going
to
be bad.
This is the kind of, when in college, I used to like do like triple, quadruple layers. It's that kind of weather.
Yep. It's a bit like the whole soccer football thing. Football, a game you play with your feet.
Yeah, no, but I agree with you on that one. That one actually makes no sense.
Wow.
But, yeah.
Okay.
And I agree
just
with you.
One time.
Yep, exactly. Two non-sports fans here, by the way, Guy. But you know, when it comes down to the World Cup, all of a sudden I'm a sports fan.
Me too.
So, yeah,
I did watch it on Saturday. Now I pretend like I know the players.
Exactly. But I'm so and it's not because of my British heritage, but it is absolutely football. That is indisputable.
Mm-hmm. Good talk. All right, Charlie. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Let's go to markets. Okay, so we were talking about oil before the break. WTI is off by 1.6% at 78. Brent off by 1.5. But before this, we saw a bit of a rally, and there's multiple things in play. One is that China is easing, so that's going to help certain commodities. Two, you had OPEC continuing to cut production, not doing anything yesterday in its virtual meeting. Three, you have Europe is no longer importing Russian oil as of today. There's an oil price cap now where you can buy Russian oil if it's under $60. If it's over $60 and you have to find different tankers and insurance companies, it gets complicated and gets expensive. So what does all this mean? We're joined now by Bloomberg Energy and Commodities Managing Editor Emma Ross Thomas. Emma, good to chat with you. What is the biggest question mark that you have for the oil market as we see the sanctions, as we see the oil price cap starting to evolve here?
So I suppose the first big question I would say is China, obviously, as you alluded to earlier. But when it comes to the sanctions, the real question mark is Moscow's reaction. So what we've had so far, we've had, the fact that the G7 and the EU decided on a level of $60, that is above the level that the Urals, or the Russian flagship benchmark, whatever you want to call it, is already trading at. That was the biggest signal that the G7 really wanted to keep Russian oil flowing, right? If anyone ever had any doubt about what the aim of the price cap was, it was that. So, and we had late last week, I think it was Thursday, Lavrov, the foreign minister, said that the price cap was irrelevant, that those transactions with countries like India and China would continue and no one needed to look at the price cap. So that was a sort of indication that the barrels would keep flowing. But we've had the oil minister saying, hinting that possibly production would be cut. And there is precedent, of course, of Russia retaliating to sanctions by cutting production. So far, we've seen it with gas. So the real question is, how is Russia going to react? We had the Kremlin this morning came out and said they were sort of evaluating, they were working on a response. There is a sense, I think, that there's not a massive rush, but we need to see. I mean, there are kind of small ways that they could retaliate. Europe is still getting oil down the Drizba pipeline. Bulgaria is still receiving seaborne oil imports. So those would be sort of small retaliations, if you like.
Yep.
But I think the thing to remember is that, the price cap was designed and has been executed in a way to make it as attractive as possible for Russia to continue exporting oil.
The Americans want the Russians to continue to ship oil to the rest of the world.
Yeah, that's right. And let's remember, the G7 is already stopping imports into its own countries. So the price cap was all about Russian oil being sold to countries like India and China and Turkey. And basically what happened is in May, I think it was, the EU came out with a sanction package that was incredibly strict. It would have stopped any Russian oil being transported around the world without, basically, because Europe has the stranglehold on insurance and other financial services, right? So it, and the Americans said, wow, that is really going to push up the price of oil, because if you knock out Russian production...
And this was the time that Biden was really concerned about the price of oil because it was having a massive impact on inflation.
Yeah, that's right. And at the same time, remember, more or less at the same time, Biden was going to Saudi Arabia trying to encourage the Saudis to increase production. The Saudis were saying that's a decision for OPEC. And then, of course, what OPEC did was cut production. So all those things sort of came at the same time.
If this is going to be like a fluid situation and we can adjust the price cap, et cetera, as we go, how are we going to know if it's actually working? Like, when are the flows going to shake out? When an insurance company is going to be okay taking on the risk? When are the tankers going to be okay taking on the risk?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we have already, when it comes to the flows being rerouted, we've already seen, of course, that flows to Europe have practically stopped. And instead, what we've seen is this massive shift towards Asia. I mean, right now, I mean, slightly in the weeds here, but right now there is a question mark over ships going through the Bosphorus Strait in Turkey. There are a few ships waiting outside the Bosphorus because the Turkish government basically has demands about insurance paperwork that the insurance companies can't quite meet. So we've got a small problem there. I mean, let's see if that escalates or if that's sorted out. I mean, there are negotiations ongoing, so, you know, hopefully that will get sorted out. I think it is also true that, you know, there is this sort of shadow fleet. So I don't think anyone expects all the oil to be traded underneath the cap. But I mean, I would just point you to the Indian energy minister this morning came out and said that he had no concerns at all about the price cap. And
so when you talk about the shadow fleet, you're talking about these are tankers that Russia has built up that are not, are they going to be insured domestically by the Russians? How does that fleet actually work?
So, I mean, a few things. One, what we have seen is that tankers that would normally be retiring have not been retired. So we've got a sort of older Russian tanker fleet.
Because they're not risky.
And we've also got alternative. So if you're trying to move Russian oil and you don't want to use a G7 insurer, then there are other options. Not all of them have been recognized. I think there's a question mark, actually, as to whether Russian insurance is accepted by China. There have been sort of conflicting reports on that. And I think we've had Chinese refiners asking the Chinese state to step in. So there are options, but I don't think anyone thinks that the alternatives to European insurance and shipping are big enough to cover the entirety of Russian oil production.
And also, there's just like more risk to that, too. I mean, if things change, etc. I'm also wondering, so we spoke to Hagar Chamali. She was part of Treasury when they were inputting the Iranian sanctions on. And the idea that we could have gone in a different direction, right? Like secondary sanctions with an incentive for countries that still buy Iranian oil to materially reduce that oil. Do we have a sense as why we didn't go this direction when it comes to Russia?
So I think, and I realize I didn't answer your previous question, which is how will we know if they're working? And this sort of answers your next question, which is define working. And I think that's the most important thing to remember here is that what the G7 price cap set out to achieve is to keep Russian oil flowing while also curbing revenues to Moscow. But the first part of that is much more important than the second part, because it came as a response to these EU sanctions, which seemed to risk completely choking off Russian production, which of course would have led to a spike in oil prices and inflation and all the rest of it. So I think the question about why this is different, it's the stated goal of the G7, whatever you want to call it, initiative, is that those Russian barrels remain on the market.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't sound complicated. Emma, thanks a lot. Emma Ross-Thomas joining us there. Really appreciate it. Let's continue with the market conversation. This time go back to the equity market. We're now down 1.5% with the S&P. Jess Menton here, who covers stocks for Bloomberg, joins us. Jess, why are we down so much?
Well, what I've been talking to my sources, some of them pointed toward the services sector data that we got from ISM this morning that still showed resiliency in the services sector. And so that really signals how there's this impulse among basically still, despite this strong inflationary impulse in services, it's more widespread than, say, the disinflationary pressures that we've seen in the goods sector. So you can really correspond that to, say, if you're looking at particular sectors and industries that would benefit more toward, if they're more goods oriented, they'll probably benefit a bit more. Whereas if you're more services oriented toward the consumer, still potentially finding some challenges there heading into 2023.
And so I'm assuming, Jess, the Fed looks at this and goes, yeah, we need probably to raise rates quite a lot more from here. I'm looking at a 5-year that's up by 11 basis points.
Right. And when you see a quick move there when we're looking at yields, whether it's the 10-year or the 2-year, that's obviously going to pressure the broader equity markets, whether we're looking at technology and growth shares, obviously discretionary, which has been hit hard this year. But also just looking at what's happening with the swaps, still a similar increase to those expectations with where the Fed terminal rate will be, with markets indicating a peak close to around 5% still in the middle of next year. But again, even looking beyond, which most investors thinking that we'll see 55 basis point hike at that meeting next month, next week. But we are going to get the update from the Federal Reserve on their forecast, which will include their dot plots at this meeting and their quarterly projections. So that's going to be a really key focus to see not just what's going to happen necessarily at that meeting, but what does the rate outlook picture look like? And we're going to get the CPI the day before the Fed decision. So that could have a lot of implications depending on whether or not we could see a particular pattern emerging with inflation cooling, or if it's still going to remain sticky. When I'm talking to economists, they're saying that we're obviously seeing those implications where on the good side of things that's improving, but it's going to be a lot stickier on the services side. And that's where it's really going to impact particular companies and stock prices when they're more geared towards services.
But how much of this can also be just book squaring too in the end of the year? I appreciate that the CPI and the Fed and the ECB and the BOE next week. Next week's going to be a big week. But until then, how many hedge funds have just been like, look, I'm out, I did my thing, and I'm done, I'm at the beach?
Well, the whole big thing with tax loss harvesting when we are going into December. And I think that's interesting because for today's Taking Stock column, I took a look at what was happening with the Russell 2000. And heading into today, it was already up more than 14% since its September low. And typically, you see small caps struggle more early on in December, and then they pick up steam in the second half of the month. And a lot of that does square away with what happens with tax harvest losses, and in particular just because of what's been happening this year, not just with small caps, but obviously with large caps, there most likely will be a lot of tax loss harvesting because of this year. And Bank of America actually had put out a note recently where they were looking at particular beaten down stocks, whether you were looking at Facebook, Meta, you're looking at Match.com, Caesars, a lot of these stocks, especially when it comes to mutual funds, because that deadline actually was toward the end of October. They were expecting a lot of those stocks to see a bounce back in November, December, and January because of investors trying to deal with that through tax loss harvesting. So some of those stocks they were anticipating could potentially see a bounce into January.
Yep, no, it's a thing. All right, Jess, really appreciate Jess Menton. We appreciate your time today. I think the move into next week is going to be amazing. And then after that, I really do think that people are going to start going on vacation or decorate their tree, right, perchance?
Maybe. If they've been bothered to put it up.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, those grinchy people. All right, this is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. So we've been talking about what's leading the equity market here in the U.S. lower, what's triggering a move higher in the dollar as well as bond yields. And the answer we keep coming back to is the ISM services data. So maybe we should spend some time talking about the ISM services data. So joining us now, Bloomberg's Michael McKee. Mike, what was so upsetting to the markets in this number?
This number. The number went up. It surprised by going up to 56.5 from 54.4. And nobody expected that. They thought that we would have a weaker services reading, that things were starting to slow down some. And then the business activity index just skyrocketed up to 64.7 from 55.7. Now, the thing to remember about these ISM numbers is they compare month to month. So what it tells you is that business leaders were more optimistic in November than they were in October, but it doesn't necessarily compare with, tell you something about over the past year or whatever like that.
Yeah.
But because it's a contemporaneous number, it suggests to people on Wall Street that the economy is stronger than they thought. And, of course, we all know what that means.
It tells you, it's about a momentum story, isn't it, Mike? This is not an economy that is losing momentum on the services side.
No, it doesn't appear to be. It appears we still have some supplier delivery problems because we saw backlog of orders falling only a little bit and supplier deliveries getting slower. So it does look like at this point we're still seeing strength in the economy that the Fed hasn't been able to address.
So based on that, do we trust these numbers? Like, we are already seeing some kind of downtrend. Are there seasonal distortions with this that we need to be aware of?
No, because it's month over month, so it's not seasonally.
But in terms
distorted.
Of, like, are certain companies going to hire, but, like, for the next 6 weeks and then?
Yeah, I mean, the hiring numbers were still, actually, they went up to 51.5, so you'd kind of expect that. During the month of November, it doesn't maybe square necessarily, and I know you talked with Anthony Nieves, the director of the survey, about it, with the fact that we lost 30,000 retail jobs, but they found some jobs somewhere else in that period. And this all seems to point back to the issue that everybody's having, which is we can't find workers, so we're still trying to hire, maybe not as many in the past, but we're still trying to hire, and we're going to hold on to the people we got.
So how do you think the Fed's going to feel about this number?
Well, I think what they're going to look at is the prices paid number, which barely moved down. And when you go back to what Alan Greenspan, that would be a long time ago.
Yeah.
I said that the other day to somebody.
I mean, it was Ira.
Greenspan, they said, "You're telling me I'm old."
I think that was Ira Jersey on Friday. Yeah. Yes.
When you go back to what Jay Powell said last Wednesday about how they know from other data that the rent portion of inflation is going to start going down and the goods prices are going down. So what they're worried about is services prices. This obviously is still an issue. And we saw the manufacturing PMI prices paid fall hugely. And now services is just barely moving. So they obviously have more work to do, which is what's scaring the markets.
Just because data comes in strong, when do we know if it really is met with consistent, sticky pay rises? And, like, when do the pay rises get worrisome? Like, I understand that average hourly earnings we saw, over 5% on Friday. We were talking earlier about an airline looking at 34% raise for pilots over 4 years. Like, at what point do the numbers become very scary versus monitoring?
Well, I think they're starting to become a little scary. Maybe that background dum-dum-dum-dum news
like Jaws, yeah.
It's starting to happen.
Like, we don't
see the
fin yet, but, like, we know it's coming.
Because the Fed is looking at month after month after month to seeing the direction that we're going, and the direction we're going is the wrong way with wages at this point. So they're already being concerned. It isn't going to change too much with what the Fed is doing because they have already raised rates enough that at this point they want to wait and see how the lagged effects of what they've done are going to start hitting the economy as we get into 2023. So they are going to slow down the pace of rate increases. But it doesn't change the fact that they're going to keep going as long as they feel they need to. And that, I think, is the part that worries the markets, is that we're now maybe looking at something above 5% for a terminal rate. Although, interestingly enough, I looked at the Fed Funds futures trading, and they haven't moved all that much. I think they moved up about 6 or 7 basis points for the terminal rate. So markets may be a little upset, and you may be seeing a little reaction in contemporaneous trading today, but there's not a huge amount of fear in the marketplace.
It looks fairly quiet for the rest of the week. I'm just looking through the data we're going to get. We obviously get claims, got a bit of PPI data that's going to hit the tape as well. UMish coming out towards the back end of the week. Is any of this data, Mike, do you think any of this data has the potential to sort of upset the apple cart?
I don't think it'll upset the apple cart. I think the Fed will look at PPI, and get a sense for what companies are charging and whether that's starting to ease up a little bit. And we should see some easing in some areas like commodity prices. Gasoline prices are certainly down. But are underlying prices still rising? Is that the question? And then everybody's looking at the Michigan numbers now for what consumer expectations for inflation are. So that will be interesting to see. But this is not the week that's going to make people feel differently. It'll be the following week. It'll be
the
Tuesday with the CPI and Wednesday with the Fed decision.
And then, at least in D.C., though, the action will be tomorrow. Well, I guess in Georgia. The runoff in Georgia, which I'm particularly looking forward to, kind of where the margin is between the two candidates. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg's Michael McKee, Bloomberg's economics and policy correspondent. I mean, that's my thing. In the next 24 hours, we get the Georgia runoff. That will decide by how much the Democrats control the Senate and by what percentage the win will be, how tight the race will be. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Sorry, politics, Alex Steele, politics. I'm still struggling.
No, I don't like politicians, but I like talking politics. Can I make that distinction?
I think you probably can.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoyed the show. This is Bloomberg.